And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monk. Cincinnati City Council fails to suspend another one of its members. We start the weekly news review with WVXU reporter Becca Costello, who joins us via Zoom. Becca, thanks for spending some time with us today.
Absolutely. Happy to be here, Michael.
Well, we're talking about Councilman Wendell Young, and we should note that his wife apparently appeared on another radio station, The Buzz, with host Lincoln Ware just a little bit ago. So we'll talk a little bit about what we heard she said on that station. But for the purposes of the beginning of our conversation, Becca, let's talk about what happened in the council chambers this week. As it relates to Councilman Young, what was this suspension effort like? It seemed like some weird allegiances emerged, people voting to suspend, but also expressing sympathy. This was a lot different than the other ones.
Yeah, absolutely. And the start of that is to clarify that the type of charge that Councilmember Young is charged with is very, very different from the previous three council members. It's a completely different situation. And it is, as several council members said during the hearing on Wednesday, several said they thought he would be exonerated, that the charges would be dropped, that it just would end up being sort of not a thing. And so it is a very different situation. But it is very clearly a lot of politics going on, not even behind the scenes necessarily, just kind of out in the open about, concerning what happens with this. Now, the suspension vote did fail. It needed 7 votes in order to pass. And Councilmember Wendell Young was not able to vote on it because he is the person under consideration. There were 6 votes to suspend and 2 council members abstaining. So that meant that the suspension did not go through.
Tell us which council members voted to suspend Councilman Young.
So voting for suspension were council members Seelbach and Landsman, who are also part of that so-called Gang of Five that this all stems from, fellow Democrats along with Wendell Young. Also Democrat David Mann, Republicans Liz Keating and Betsy Sunderman, Democrat Jan Michelle Lemon Kearney, and then voting to abstain or choosing not to vote rather were Vice Mayor Christopher Smitherman, who's an independent, and Republican Steve Gooden.
We heard Councilwoman Jan Michelle Kearney say that even when she was voting to suspend her colleague Wendell Young, that she still believes he will be exonerated for those charges. Do we know any more about how she squares those perspectives of voting to suspend while also believing he's innocent?
Yeah, and she was not alone in that perspective, certainly. And she actually spent several minutes talking about Young's record in the military and in the Cincinnati police, and actually said, we should be voting to honor Councilmember Young today rather than voting to suspend him. So she really gave a very passionate defense of his character and his track record on council. At the same time, there are concerns here of if and how Councilmember Young is suspended, because if he's suspended, there will be a temporary replacement appointed there. Now, if council were to have suspended him, then that replacement would be chosen by Councilmember Chris Seelbach, according to just the tenets of that ordinance that was recently approved by voters, or rather charter amendment approved by voters. But since they didn't suspend, what happens next is there's a motion in process at the Ohio Supreme Court. If Councilmember Young is suspended that way, then a Hamilton County judge will appoint a temporary replacement. And as we've seen, this happened twice already in the last 6 months. That replacement could very well be a Republican replacing Democrat Wendell Young on council. And so there are all of these concerns about, who would truly represent the voters in terms of replacing Young if he were to be suspended.
Kathy Young, Wendell Young's wife, appeared on The Buzz talking to local radio host Lincoln Ware this morning. We've seen some tweets going around recapping this conversation, particularly from our friend Chris Wetterick at the Business Courier. And Kathy Young seemed rather upset about this, particularly the fact that the Hamilton County Democratic Party also asked Wendell Young to resign from council just yesterday. What can you tell us about Kathy Young's statements this morning?
That's right. And we did get some clarification, too, from Kathy on why Councilmember Young has chosen not to resign and it seems so far to say he will not resign. We talked about that replacement process. That's another thing that, since You mentioned the Democratic Party has asked Councilmember Young to resign, because if he resigns rather than being suspended, then in that case, Councilmember Seelbach would choose his replacement as well. So it would mean the Democrats could guarantee they would hold control of that seat. It is sort of worth noting at this point that officially council is nonpartisan, although there are very clearly these two major political parties at play here. Kathy Young said that the main reason that Councilmember Young cannot resign is he needs access to the health care that he gets through the city as an employee, as a public servant, and he would lose that health care if he resigned. If he is suspended, he would continue receiving the salary and the health benefits that come with that.
Well, it's always something to talk about at Cincinnati City Hall, and our Becca Costello is always on top of it. You can read her reporting at WVXU.org and listen for it throughout the day here on 91.7. Becca, happy Friday. Have a great long weekend.
Thanks, Michael. You too.
Meanwhile, City Council in Lebanon also faced an unusual week as the city adopted a measure against abortion, prompting one member to resign. WVXU reporter Jolene Almendarez was there. She's with us now via Zoom. Jolene, thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me today, Michael.
Well, take us to Lebanon. This is now the only city in the entire state of Ohio to ban abortion, but can cities do that?
Right. So according to people who support the ordinance, they say that this recent vote makes Lebanon the 29th city in the whole country to pass a similar ordinance. Most of the other cities are in Texas, and a representative from an organization that says what they call creating a sanctuary city for the unborn was actually there the night of the vote to talk about, why council should be voting for this kind of thing and how they allegedly legally have the right to do so. But the ACLU of Ohio says that they are preparing to launch a legal campaign against it.
Where were abortions taking place in Lebanon prior to the city council's vote?
Right. So that was a really big issue during the council vote, because there are no clinics that provide abortion in all of Warren County, which is where Lebanon is. And so the mayor there, Mayor Amy Brewer, kind of was really adamant that, hey, you are not losing any rights. If you want to leave the city to have an abortion, she says, you can still do that.
Well, was there some type of proposal to construct an abortion facility in the city?
Not at all. Not at all. And people who opposed the ordinance, which passed it unanimously, said that this was really about politics. This was about people who are, lawmakers in a smaller town in Ohio wanting to kind of get a lot of national attention, which they did get. And especially there's a council member who says people who break this new ordinance could receive up to 6 months in jail and $1,000 fine.
Jolene, you were there in Warren County covering this meeting. Can you just describe for us what it was like? I'm sure it was quite unusual for a Lebanon City Council meeting to draw such a crowd inside and outside the building.
It was fascinating. There were over 100 people outside with signs protesting. Outside, it was mostly people who opposed the ordinance, but there were a lot of pro-life people as well. I talked to one woman who was pro-life, who had a sign with a gun strapped to her leg, talking about the importance of preserving life. But inside was a different story. There was about 100 people inside, primarily in support of the ordinance, talking to council about how they thought it was a brave stance to take. So it really was a little bit of everything.
There was one council member who opposed this proposal, but did not end up casting a vote because she resigned. Can you tell us about her and what her position was?
Right. Krista Wyatt. So technically in Lebanon, you're not supposed to be partisan if you're on council, which is something Krista Wyatt has, repeatedly said. She resigned saying that she just no longer wants to be affiliated with council. She feels there are people on council who are pushing their own personal agendas, their own religious beliefs on what's supposed to be a diverse city. And she doesn't think that represents the people of Lebanon very well. And so she resigned. There was a written statement that was kind of tweeted out that she wrote saying that, you know, it's her hometown, but she, as a quote, as a respectful, decent human being, I can no longer allow my name to be associated with Lebanon City Council.
So what happens next? This has been adopted and is a measure, and it does sound like there is at least one or more legal challenges ahead.
Right. So according to City Council, this goes into effect immediately. It's already the law of the land. And, you know, I reached out to the ACLU. They are saying that they do want to launch some kind of legal action against the city. They said that on social media, and in a email to me, they told me that they were weighing their options of what and how they're going to do it. And so right now, it's just a matter of waiting to see what comes next. In places like Lubbock, Texas, where similar things were passed, those have been overturned. But Lubbock was a little bit different because in Lubbock, there were already places who were providing abortions. And so it was a little bit different. But there are places in Texas where bans like this are still in effect.
That's WVXU reporter Jolene Almendarez. You can read her reporting at WVXU.org and listen for it throughout the day here on 91.7. Jolene, thank you for spending part of your Friday with us. Hope you have a great long weekend.
Thank you. You too, Michael.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. More charges against local protesters have been dropped following last summer's racial justice protests here. Inquirer reporter Cameron Knight joins us now to talk about that via Zoom. Cameron, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you so much.
This coverage that you provide seems to offer quite a tour of the way the Hamilton County Municipal Court system works. So these are hundreds of cases that have been spread out across more than a dozen different judges. But the most recent news is that about 101 protesters who were arrested a year ago during those nationwide demonstrations for racial justice following the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, those charges have been dropped. Why were these charges dropped?
Well, it's interesting. So there's the way the cases have been handled have kind of ranged between, you know, constitutional dismissals from judges that you might consider to be kind of left-leaning Democratic judges, to all the way to very specific problems with legal procedure related to discovery. So it's been a really kind of bizarre set of cases. But on Friday of last week, a large group of cases were dropped by the city. The city chose to drop the charges. And these were cases from five different judges, all of whom essentially said that the curfew the mayor instituted was unconstitutional and violated First Amendment rights. So those five judges, there are 14 judges on the municipal court, by the way. So there's 14 different ways they could have all been handled. But five judges said that the curfew was unconstitutional. And the city initially appealed those rulings to the First District Court of Appeals. And the First District Court of Appeals hadn't dealt with them yet. But the city proactively went in there and dismissed 101 of those cases. So that handles most, if not all, of the cases in which the judges said the curfew was unconstitutional.
But originally there were like 500 people. There were 500.
Sure. Yeah, we're talking about 500 cases here. So that's, you know, about 20% right there out the window. And then the other aspect of this is that the defense attorneys for many of these people have requested specific body camera for their individual clients. They want body camera image showing that they participated, that like as a course of evidence. They want to see.
You're talking about the Cincinnati Mass Defense Coalition that filed
Correct,
what was called a
yeah.
motion to compel discovery, according to your reporting. And so, like, they're basically saying, you say our clients were at the scenes of these protests, so provide the body camera footage and prove it, right?
Essentially, yes. And the city, in a kind of a surprising document, filed a response to that, which is typical in court. You know, a motion is filed, and then a response is filed to that motion, and it goes back and forth. But the response to that was essentially, we can't do it. We don't have the manpower. We don't have the time. There's just no way that we can complete this complete this task of going through thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of body camera footage. Now, they asked in that document for the judges to determine how that should proceed. I'm sure there were probably some discussions in chambers or discussions between attorneys and judges and things like that. But on the record, in terms of a response from judges, there really hasn't been any to that request for them to clarify. But who knows what's happened behind closed doors. So the city has been quietly dismissing those cases too. And it appears that they're dismissing them in groups before each judge. My understanding is that it takes a lot of time to do all of this because it's about 500 cases. It's a lot of paperwork. They're addressing kind of the judges, each group of cases before each judge on different timelines because each judge has kind of set a different schedule for these cases. There are the five judges who ruled that they were unconstitutional, and those cases went to appeals, and those cases were dropped. And then there's another five judges who the city has dropped the cases in their court as well.
So
due to this discovery issue.
I'm wondering, Cameron, if you can just help us understand here, because say you're in that group of 101 that had those charges dropped last Friday, you know, you're probably feeling all right. But if you're not in that group, you might be feeling like, is this coming for me too? Am I going to get this opportunity? Is there any indication that all of these charges will eventually be dropped?
Yeah, it's very unclear. The city has said, and I've asked them multiple times, the city has said that they're handling cases on an individual basis, a case-by-case basis. By the looks of things, it seems like if you were only charged with misconduct in an emergency, which is the curfew violation, if that's your only charge, that most of those people, I would say, I would estimate maybe 3/4 of those people, maybe just 2/3 of those people, have had their cases dropped, and the trend seems to be that they are dropping those cases regardless of who the judge is. But there are still 4 judges remaining who have cases that have not been addressed. Or if they have been addressed, it's been addressed in the last couple of days.
And have those judges said anything to you?
They have not yet. I haven't reached out to them today, but I mean, it happened so quickly that there could be even more cases dropped in the last couple of days that I don't know about.
Well, you cover the courts pretty regularly, and I'm wondering if you can help us understand how this process just works in general, because again, if you're part of the group of 101, you're probably feeling okay that the charges are now gone,
sure,
but you might be left in limbo if you're not in that group, but you do face a charge. Are these just automatically dispersed among the Hamilton County Municipal judges, and is it a luck of the draw situation here if the rest of the charges aren't dropped?
That's honestly what drew me to kind of following these cases, is that at first, when some judges started dropping them on constitutional grounds and other judges kind of rejected that argument, that was the interesting thing because, yeah, by all accounts, like you just kind of draw, you like they get drawn out of a hat and you're assigned a judge at random. And then it just depends on the nature of the judge. Now, granted, it seems like in the end that maybe, I can't say for sure, but it seems to be trending in the direction that all of these charges will be dismissed one way or another. But when you're in the middle of this, it seems like that justice might look differently depending on what judge you get. So that was, again, a very interesting aspect of this case, is that you have these judges reacting in different ways to different arguments, giving validity to some arguments and rejecting others. I found it fascinating as someone who like follows courts. It's a little bit, I would say, wonky if you don't, because some of it gets a little technical. But yeah, it was fascinating. 14 different judges, and the cases literally could have gone 14 different ways. And not only that, there's a whole nother group of people who've been charged with more specific crimes like criminal damaging or obstructing justice or resisting arrest. And that's a much smaller group of people. You're talking maybe a few dozen who those cases are continuing. So there will be protest cases, to people who face more than one charge or more serious charges that are going on well after well after a year of the protests.
I don't mean to put you on the spot here, Cameron, if you don't know the answer to this, and I apologize, but there were protests all across the country, arrests in many cities. Do we know what's happening elsewhere, for example? Are we seeing this be a trend, that the charges associated with the protests of last summer being dropped?
I mean, I've seen media reports of some cities going one way, some cities going the other. The interesting thing is that, I mean, in our city, we had this mayor-instituted curfew, which was not necessarily how it was handled in every other city. So it's sort of a specific legal argument. But yeah, I mean, there have been protesters in other cities who've had their charges dropped. But there's plenty of people who are sitting there, like the remainder of the people in Cincinnati, who are still sitting in court, metaphorically speaking, waiting to find out what's going to happen.
Cameron Knight is a reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. Cameron, thank you so much for coming on the program today and explaining this complicated situation. I'm sure we'll have cause to talk again soon. Hope you have a great weekend.
Thank you. Have a good one.
And the local housing market remains hot, but some parts of the area are seeing property values decline. We're going to look at that next. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. With the local real estate market experiencing historic demand and rising prices, why are property values in some local suburbs dropping? WCPO reporters Dan Monk and Lucy May explored that issue. They join us now via Zoom. Dan, welcome back to our show.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
And Lucy, welcome to you also.
Thank you so much, neighbor.
It's good to see you on the air and sometimes on occasion on the sidewalk. So thanks for being
That's
with us
right.
to share some of this reporting. Take us to Lincoln Heights. I was really surprised to read at the very beginning of this story that there's a gentleman there who made an investment in a three-family rental property and went to have it appraised. And apparently, based on that appraisal, it's valued at less than half of what he paid for it 17 years ago. Dan, this is significantly against the trend that we're hearing so much about in the local real estate market. So what's going on?
Well, I think some neighborhoods are having a rough time of it compared to others. That's the bottom line. It's, you know, it's one of the ways that Americans generate wealth is home ownership and increasing property values over time. And this analysis by Tom Carroll, the village manager of Silverton, really an eye-opener for me, because he compared real estate values in the last five valuations by the Hamilton County Auditor's Office, and he found four jurisdictions where the real estate values, when adjusted for inflation, actually dropped more than 30% since 2008. Lincoln Heights had the biggest drop, more than 40%, and then Springdale, Addison, and Elmwood Place all declined by more than 30%.
And we have had Tom Carroll on this program multiple times, including most recently, to talk a little bit about this particular issue. Lucy, the trouble with Lincoln Heights, though, in particular, some of the challenges that its residents face, this isn't anything new. I mean, it dates back to its founding in a lot of ways, right?
Right. It dates back. Lincoln Heights is celebrating 75 years, and these problems go all the way back then. When residents of the area that's now Lincoln Heights tried to incorporate, they drew boundaries that included some of what is now GE Aviation. And of course, if that industrial land had been part of Lincoln Heights, you can imagine the kind of tax revenues that would have come to the village over these many years. But that effort was fought by both the company and Hamilton County officials. And as a result, Lincoln Heights, to successfully incorporate, has a very, very tiny land mass that doesn't include any of the industrial land that is now GE Aviation in Evendale, or any of the industrial land to the other side of Lincoln Heights in Lachlan. And that's meant Lincoln Heights counts on its property values that are residential and the businesses that exist there And that's been tough from the beginning. The village manager there, Joyce Powderill, told us, you know, Lincoln Heights started at a deficit and it's been trying to dig its way out of this hole for 75 years. And that's a challenge. And it gets more challenging during these economic downturns like the housing crisis of 2008. And as the community struggles, the people living there can struggle. And when you own your home, if you don't have a lot of money to fix it up and make repairs, it's kind of a cycle that just goes on and on.
And Lucy, based on the analysis by Silverton Village Manager Tom Carroll, Lincoln Heights, again, as Dan noted, ranked last with a 43% decline in its property values when adjusted for inflation. And so can you talk a little bit about how that impacts residents specifically, like Daryl Daniels, who you all profile as part of this deep story? He's the gentleman I referenced at the beginning. He had bought a three family 17 years ago, and he spent $88,000 on it then. And apparently when he went to refinance, the bank appraised it for less than half of that. What is the impact on an individual like him?
Well, Dan talked to Daryl Daniels, but what really struck me about Dan's terrific interview with him was that he bought in Lincoln Heights because he cares about this community. He grew up in this community, has a lot of affection for it, and he wanted to own a rental property that could help his neighbors, good places where people could stay. And he had a vision for reinvesting and fixing it up. But it's hard to reinvest in a property when it's declining in value. You know, he can't borrow money against that. It's less, it's worth less than what he bought it for. So it gets him kind of stuck in this cycle where he thought he was doing a good thing for the village, and now he's kind of stuck. Dan, I don't know if you have anything else you want to add about his experience.
No, actually, I think you covered it pretty well.
Well, Dan, tell us, because as you noted, this is a village that relies heavily on property tax revenue. And with that being declining, they find themselves in trouble. Is there federal help here based on the American Rescue Plan, for example?
Yeah, that is one option. Another option is that Lincoln Heights is now working with the Port Authority, and they have in excess of 100 vacant lots there where the village has bought property and demolished vacant homes, mostly on these sites. So they do have sites where it will be possible to develop new housing, maybe even bring some commercial development into the area. So I think that's one of the things they're going to be working on in terms of trying to build the wealth, build the tax base, and give Lincoln Heights residents more options for jobs and housing.
So, Dan, with the challenges that Lincoln Heights faces, though, what kind of indication did you get about what their marketing plan might be? Why would they suggest people invest in the community that's faced the challenges that it does?
Well, it has some of the same advantages as Lockland and Evendale, their neighbors on either side. It's got highway frontage. There is an exit that leads directly to the neighborhood, and there is commercial property that can be developed, especially toward the highway side of the village. So I think they do have some things that they can use to market themselves and build some value, but they're not going to be able to do it alone. They don't have the enough wealth to, you know, do things like Cincinnati does, for example, you know, abate taxes and offer, you know, job creation tax credits, and they don't have an economic development department. So, you know, some of the tools that were used to rebuild the urban core in the last 15 years are just not going to be available in a place like Lincoln Heights, or really many of the first ring suburbs that are basically small towns and villages that don't have the assets, don't have the resources to aggressively vie for industrial development the way a big city does.
We're talking with Dan Monk and Lucy May from WCPO. Lucy, I learned from this reporting something I didn't know before, certainly, and that was that Lincoln Heights once had its own school district before it merged into Princeton. And apparently that happened back in 1970. And there was some conversation in this reporting that indicates some might believe that the fate of the town might be different had that merger not happened, right?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of things that could have changed the fate of Lincoln Heights over the years. Certainly having its own school district was one of them. But One thing, if you don't mind, that I'd like to add to what Dan was saying in terms of how Lincoln Heights is marketing itself, there is a group of young professionals that have formed this initiative called the Heights Movement, and they are really working from the ground up to organize residents to believe in their own power to improve their destiny, to get back to the village's kind of glory days of the 60s, and to really take pride in what Lincoln Heights does have. So while I think there were plenty of things that have gone wrong in Lincoln Heights history over the past 75 years, there are a lot of people who care deeply about the village who are working now to get it going in a better direction.
You are both longtime business-oriented reporters, and I'm wondering if you can just help us understand how a community like this avoids what we're seeing so widespread across the region, which is just a very low inventory for housing stock, extraordinarily high prices, a total seller's market like we haven't seen possibly ever. Even though Lincoln Heights has had a difficult time over its 75-year history, how has it been able to avoid what's happening right now that appears to be so positive, particularly for investors?
Well, I think the population generally is flowing to the Northeast. And so those are going to be the hottest markets to begin with, because that's where the most people want to live. And, you know, the first ring suburbs, there's a lot of older housing. And by first ring, I mean, you know, the jurisdictions that were first to develop after the urban core, after people started moving out of the urban core. So, and they really boomed during, World War II timeframe. And so a lot of the housing stock there is older and probably less desired by people who are now shopping for houses. And, you know, the neighborhoods that are the hottest are the ones where the most people want to live. So I think that's probably what's driving the decline in values in all of these first ring suburbs, not just Lincoln Heights.
Well, and some of the experts we talked to said you can't underestimate the influence of institutional racism, too. So I know that's not exactly what this discussion is about, but Lincoln Heights was one of the first Black-run communities founded in this part of the country. And some of the folks we talked to said that likely has played a role in this history, too.
In what way?
Well, the way the place was annexed itself, and just all of the policies that have been influencing communities in terms of wealth building and the ability to get loans and the ability to fix up your property and keep it and jobs and just everything that, that whole racism conversation has been playing out over the past year.
Lucy May and Dan Monk are reporters with WCPO. Catch their stories on Channel 9 or at WCPO.com. Dan, Lucy, thanks for spending part of your Friday with us. I hope you both have a long holiday weekend. Holiday weekend.
Oh, nice. Oh, good. Thanks. You too.
Thanks, Michael.
And now WKRC-TV reporter James Pilcher is with us to teach us about constables. James, thanks for coming back on.
Hey, thanks for having me, Michael. How are you today?
I'm doing very well. At the county level in Kentucky, there's an elected position called constable. They're elected in their districts in the county. Oftentimes, and I can say this as a Kentucky voter myself, we don't even know who these folks are or what they do. So before we get into why we're talking about constables again, would you mind telling us what a constable is?
Actually, a constable is the it dates back to the Middle Ages, believe it or not, and it's the extension of the government or the court system, and it was incorporated in the original Kentucky Constitution in 1750. So every county has at least one constable, and like you said, they're broken down by districts, and they basically are the law enforcement arm of the court system. But the problem is that in the Kentucky Constitution, they are given police powers, but no other restrictions. And they're paid on a per transaction. They're not paid a salary or anything. So they're paid every time they serve a summons, they serve a warrant, whatever. So they're supposed to be paid, but they also now can also rent themselves out to serve papers on behalf of private attorneys. So that's basically the position. what's happened in many cases, especially in smaller counties or not smaller geographically, smaller population wise, especially in the southern and eastern parts of the state, that they are also seen as ancillary or auxiliary law enforcement because, you know, the sheriff's department may not have enough deputies to cover an entire county. So they're kind of used as a backup law enforcement. The problem is, and this is where we're going to get into why we're talking about it, is that they're not required to undergo any law enforcement training at all.
Right. These aren't graduates of the police academy, for example.
They are not. They are elected officials, and that's it. That's the only requirement you have to have. You have to be a certain age and be a Kentucky resident and all of that. But apart from that, no, you do not have to have any law enforcement training. So what we've seen throughout the years is people either acting badly while they're a constable or abusing their position as a constable and acting like a law enforcement and overextending their authority or going out of jurisdictions or whatever. So, you know, and that's what leads us to why we're talking about it.
We're going to talk about Kenton County Constable Danny Cope, who was arrested on charges out of Boone County. Tell us what he's accused of doing.
Well, he was there to collect a debt on behalf of an insurance company, but he pulled his gun and held the person captive in his own apartment, threatened to kill him. And so he is he has one felony and two misdemeanors, including wanton endangerment and unlawful use of authority,
because he was presenting himself as a police officer, allegedly.
Right, exactly. And this isn't the first time in this area that's happened. There was a well-known Kenton County constable who was flashing blue lights and pulling people over, even though the county had not given him authority to do that. A county can authorize a constable to have blue lights on their cars, but it has to come from the county. The county has to give him that authority. Well, then back in the 2000s, this guy didn't do it. And so he was arrested twice or charged twice with impersonating a police officer. And he even tried to do it even when he wasn't a constable, and he went to prison for it. And Matt Bevin pardoned him on his way out of office, the former governor. So the most recent really egregious example of this was last year, two Pulaski County constables were pulling people over and seizing their property, saying, we suspect you have drugs or whatever. Now, police officers are allowed to do that, but these guys are not. So they were taking their money, they were taking their cash, they were seizing their cars or whatever. Well, the FBI got involved and investigated, and then they went to arrest these guys, and the guy shot an FBI agent during the course of that arrest. So, you know, this has been an ongoing issue for decades. You know, my previous position, I wrote a couple of stories about it and how there's been moves to change it. And then we have just this latest example of this. And a local legislator, Adam Koenig, has been trying for 12 years. He's been trying to either eliminate the position because it's redundant or to at least get them to, if you're going to give them police powers, they need to have police training. He made it all the way through the House and through a Senate committee last year, but it's been killed all 4 or 5 times now.
So this is just a piece of legislation that for some reason stalls when it seems to make sense to at least a majority of lawmakers in the state House. Is there some type of lobbying arm in support of the constables? Is there someone who argues on behalf of keeping this position around?
I don't know. You know, and Adam kind of scratches his head. He just says that he doesn't come out and say it's a good old boy network, but that's basically what he's saying, because a lot of these guys have had an elected position in their counties for years. They're well-known families and they're connected, is his answer. What's interesting is that I reached out to the president of the Kentucky Constables Association, had a brief discussion with him. He was on his way to a funeral of another constable and didn't have good cell signal. And then I did some more research and found out that he'd actually been served prison time for sexual abuse of a 14-year-old, had those charges overturned, and has also been accused of misusing his blue lights.
That's the president of the association for the constables.
The president of the association, yes. So, yeah, the lobbying arm, I can tell you, I talked directly to the Kentucky League of Cities, and they are on board with trying to change this because it creates all this confusion. And like we've seen abuse, but there's also confusion on behalf of the public as to what they do and what rights and what, you know, if you get pulled over by a constable, do you have to comply? I mean, those are all, you know, public safety questions.
We're talking with James Pilcher of WKRC-TV. We'll continue to follow that one for sure. But you also reported this week about some challenges that the local library system could face, right?
Yeah, that's right. So the current proposed state budget would cut the state's contribution to the library fund by $10 million statewide. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot of money, but for the Hamilton County system, which has 41 branches, Hamilton County Cincinnati system, they get $1 million of that. Now, that again, in the greater scheme of things, it doesn't sound like a lot of money, but according to their research, every dollar they spend, it equates into $5 to $6.50 in economic benefit in a particular community. So they're saying that, and they also have, Ohio also has research showing that Ohio has the highest utilization of public libraries in the entire country, almost double the national rate in terms of visits per year, per member, things like that. So the economic benefits of a library go well beyond just, you know, having somebody, the kids being able to take out a book or you being able to get a magazine. They've become community hubs that during the pandemic, especially, they've become learning centers. They've become the ability for people who don't have high speed internet to go look for jobs, file their unemployment. They created here locally, they created a faxing service that people can come and, you know, when you have to fax in your paperwork to either avoid evictions or file your unemployment or whatever, they do it for free for those people. So it goes beyond that. It goes beyond just, like I said, books and magazines.
So if it's $1 million hit to the Cincinnati and Hamilton County library system, have they given any indication of what's to be cut? Is it those programs that you were just talking about?
No, they did. I didn't get that far into it with them in terms of, you know, what they're doing right now. They're just in, you know, lobbying mode to try to keep it in place. Cecil Thomas, the state senator from North Avondale, is really out in front on this, and he's trying to at least get it restored in the current budget and also put in an amendment to try to get it permanently in place in the budget going forward. Now, of course, you know, he's in the minority as a Democrat, but, you know, one of the things that happened is I tweeted out links to my story and people were tweeting to Martin Sheen and Emilio Estevez. Because, of course, Emilio Estevez directed and starred in that movie called
The Public,
which is based on what public libraries do for people. And it was set at the main branch of the Cincinnati Library. So it was kind of interesting just to see how that kind of took off.
So we'll have to see if President Bartlett gets involved.
Exactly. That would be pretty cool. I love that show.
All right. Well, let's talk about the Reds. I'm noticing that the Reds have been a little up and down, although more down than up this season. There were a lot of high hopes at the start of the season. They're 4 games under .500, 5 games out of first place in the National League Central. But they might have louder voices cheering them on starting next week. What are the changes coming to Reds games?
So Wednesday is the first day that all health orders are lifted, which also means all events can go to full capacity. So the Reds can sell out Great American Ballpark if they want to, if they can. So on Wednesday, it's a day game. It's a 12:35 game against the Phillies. They're calling it the reopening day. And what they're trying to do is sell it out, pack the park, and they're going to have parties at the banks and in the Dora and also at Fountain Square, where they're going to show the game. And they're going to try to treat it like a real opening day because, you know, Cincinnati and its proud tradition of opening days has kind of been cheated out of that over the last 2 years. So they're going to try and recreate that on a short notice as much as they can to try to get that energy going. And it's more about re-energizing downtown, re-energizing the businesses and the and the bars and the restaurants and all of that and get people to come back downtown than it is maybe about the Reds. Although I did have a conversation with Phil Castellani and some folks with the Reds organization and seeing if they're going to rejigger their starting lineup to try to get their number one pitcher, Sonny Gray, to start that game. So it would be a win.
Okay. But, now you're a sports analyst too.
Yeah. Well, you know, I try to.
I'm sure he loved hearing that suggestion.
But yeah, I mean, you know, obviously the Reds have been hit with some injuries and not with Joey Votto and some of their starting rotation hasn't worked out. But you know, they've got another month and a half, I think, to determine whether or not they're going to be buyers or sellers at the trade deadline and see if they'll be close enough to make a run at the wild card or even the division. Because nobody's really running away with the division either, if you look at it.
Oh, no, that's true. I mean, they're five games out. It's not even the All-Star break yet. We're a month out from that. So,
and Votto's been hurt. And, you know, if he comes back and he's anything like his former self and, you know, like I said, and Moustakas has also been in and out of the lineup. So, you know, we'll see. But again, this event on Wednesday is kind of like, I got the sense it's like everybody's like, take this big sigh of relief. We're past the pandemic. Everybody's vaccinated. Come downtown and party, basically, is what it's all about. We're reopening the state. We're reopening the res. We're reopening downtown. That's what that's all about.
I got to tell you, I did go have dinner in downtown Cincinnati just last weekend, and I walked from Covington and back. And on the walk back, the bank streets were quite crowded. So there's no question that people are ready to get back.
Had my first get together face to face for beers with my fantasy football folks last night in a year and a half. So I get you. I stayed down at the banks after my live shot. And that's what I did, you know, so
There's a real sense of energy, you know, people, especially people who obeyed and followed the restrictions and are now feeling like they can get back out there again. It was pretty interesting to see.
Yep. I'll be out there Wednesday, just to see how big the crowds are and, you know, what changes are and what it's like inside the stadium. Now, you know, how they're going to handle it with having only had half capacity, how they're going to handle it. You know, how's it going to go? Is it going to go smoothly with a packed park for the first time in 2 years? It'd be interesting.
James Pilcher from WKRC-TV. James, thanks so much for spending part of your Friday with us. I hope you have a great long weekend, too.
I'm working Monday, but, you know, that's TV life. So,
it is indeed.
Yeah, I'll have a good weekend.
Right. Well, we're not working Monday. We'll be off and back with more shows for you on Tuesday. I hope all of you listening have had a great week. Thanks for spending so much of it with us here at Cincinnati Edition. And I hope if you are taking a long weekend this weekend, that it's a good one. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. Find all of our episodes online at wvxu.org. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again on Tuesday.